in, you bastards! Come on, have a go if you think you're not enough!
Hi, my name is Robert Lendrum.
And I'm Jamie Roberts.
And this is the Running Scared Podcast,
where we review the movies that had you running away but coming back for more. What's going on, Rob? How you feeling?
I'm feeling great, buddy. Let's talk. How you been, man? How you been?
Rob, I am excited about tonight. We are doing a great movie. How you doing, man?
I'm pretty good. Had a long day with the kids outside today. It was beautiful. It was sunny. It was finally good to get them out, get them off the screens, just make them stay outside all day and do whatever the hell they wanted, run around, go wild. And you must be happy to get out of the house because weren't you stuck inside for quite some time?
We all got COVID. I'm not going to tell everybody's kind of, well, not everybody, but according to the CDC, you know, like 50% or 60% of Americans have had COVID, and now they're saying that a ton of people, one in third of Canadians, and more if you're younger, have had COVID. But let me just say this. We've been very diligent throughout the whole pandemic, but my daughter got it, then my wife got it, then my son got it, then I got it in consecutive days. Yeah. And, oh, man, it was brutal. Like, we had to be in the house. I was out of commission for like 7 to 8 days. I wasn't feeling good at all. Anyways,
So you were sick too, right? It wasn't just...
I was sick. So yeah. People that are telling me that this is like a flu, or I know that it's asymptomatic for some people. I know some people get really sick. I got through it last weekend, put in a full week of work, was feeling really good. Actually have some news there. I've been, everybody out there knows I'm a teacher. I've been teaching grade 8 for a long time. I'm making the move down to grade 4, Rob.
Is that a move up or a move down? How does that work? I don't know.
We call that a lateral move, right? Okay. It's a move down in grade, but it's like just switching schools, kind of like just kind of switch it up. And, you know, I think we all want to get different kinds of experience. So I'm excited to do that. So.
Because you're looking further ahead and you need to have some experience at that lower level. That's great. So,
absolutely.
Because you're an educated man. You've got a master's of education. You're looking beyond just the teaching game.
I am. And you know what? I got to start making some moves because I got into the education game a little bit late because in my 20s, I was not doing anything that I should have been. Actually, one of the things that I did do was I moved to Scotland and I lived there.
That's right. You were gone for a year and a half almost, right?
Yeah, I was gone for a while. Anybody that knows me, I've got good connections. My mom is Scottish. So I went to visit her hometown and I still have family over there. So I spent some time.
8 beers later, he never left.
18. I remember I got off the plane and, Rob, first thing, you were there, we were having like a little bit of party. I got back, right? This is after me, you know, eating Snickers bar, drinking Tennents and smoking Mayfairs for a whole year. And you go to me, you're like, dude, you look like a stuffed owl.
I said that. It sounds like something I might say.
That was definitely something you said. And you got to know me, man. I took it. You know, it's like, it's all good. But I did have a little extra beer weight.
Oh, fuck. For sure.
I gained a ton of weight.
I'm saying this to someone who's not in great shape, even though I try to jog a little bit, because you are now a guy who's in really good shape. So all compliments to you because you turned yourself completely around. But you came back a little like you... And like your tolerance was insane. Like when I would go drinking with you, I was like, I can't keep pace with Roberts, man. Jamie can just knock back beers all night long. I am like done after like 6, 7, 8. I'm trying to push myself up, and you're like ordering your 14th.
I don't know about that, man.
Okay, I might be exaggerating, but you were pretty like it was next level shit.
Yeah, I was like. Like I was living in Pitlochry and I was working in a cafe Biba, and like my fucking roommate at the time, Malcolm, God love him. You know, like he would just sit in his underwear on his days off playing fucking Tiger Woods golf, just cracking the beers. Like it was, and he was like 28. Like, he was older than that, man. Honestly, he was like 10 years old. He had to be in his early 30s. But one of the things that I learned when I moved out there, you know, because you go out there wanting to reconnect with your family and thinking about all this lad shit and everything. But one of the things I realized is that it's very true is fuck, everybody nails it to the pub after work, right? Mm-hmm. Every day, mm-hmm. you know, especially in a small town. That's where, like, you bang out of work and then you go into the pub and you just, like, that's what you do. You just drink. I gained, like, 45 pounds, man. It was, like, ridiculous. I came back, I could just kill it. And then, which was fine, right? And then, you know, I had an amazing time, soccer games. Like, it was really good experience. But, you know, it took me a while to kind of put some things back on the rails and just kind of get things going. And that's why kind of education and career started out a little bit later. But anyways, point is...
Yeah, sorry, can I jump in? Because the only experience I can compare it to is when I lived in Korea for about 5-6 months.
Yeah.
And it was literally my last week I was leaving. And because my other roommate had left, I had the apartment with an empty room. And so when the school brought their next teacher in, he came to my apartment. And the guy was cool. We got along just great. I don't remember the dude's name at this point, but he was a big time, like, alcoholic. And an alcoholic, what do you call it, like a functioning alcoholic. Like, he had to, like, you know, keep his hands from shaking so that he'd have a few. Okay. And he'd go to work teaching, and it was like, I was like, dude, it's like drinking through the day. And then I realized, okay, like, he's not getting hammered. He's like, I'm still young to understand this is like a huge problem. But like at the time, it's like, I guess he's like just keeping himself steady. Because when he got home, he'd be so blasted. I remember coming home one night, and my brother had come up from, he was actually in another city in Korea. He came up to help me he wanted me to take some stuff home for him. So he came up to hang out for a couple nights. We go up to my apartment. This guy is wandering around the apartment, and it's a small apartment, so he's just wandering kind of in circles in the kitchen area in like his boxers, hammered, and is so hammered that his neck muscles don't work and his head is just draped sideways over his shoulder. And he's and like a zombie, man. Like, I'm not even kidding. I was like,
he's so hammered. His neck muscles don't work.
I mean, I don't mean to make fun of someone who has this problem, but it was someone who has not encountered that before. I was super scared of this guy. I was like, what is going on?
Yeah, that's an indicator that you might need to change things up. Like, yeah. That's, that is scary, right?
So good on you, buddy. You did change things up. You came home.
I don't think I was ever going to be that bad, but I definitely, a huge wake up call for me was that I ended up coming home late in August in like 2003, and my mom came out. My mom's birthday is beginning of July, and she came out to see me with my Aunt Peg, and like just the look on her face when she saw the state of me, and then it was even worse when she came into like my living quarters, like my dresser of drawers, like it didn't have like the front on any of like the dresser. It's like. Like, there was no windows. It was a friggin' if there was a fire in the apartment, I was going to be the first to die. Like, it was not a good situation. But when you're young, I was just having, like, that's the thing. I was having so much fun, and I was traveling around the country, and I met some amazing people, and really kind of like... I was Scottish by the time I left, you know what I mean? Full accent, you know, my mom has one, so I've been listening to it my whole life. But anyways, why is that important? Well, there's a huge connection to this film tonight that we're going to review. Mm-hmm. This is Dog Soldiers, directed by Neil Marshall, starring a bunch of amazing English and Scottish actors. Rob, do you remember the first time you saw this film? Like, I know we all saw it recently because we're going to review it again, but when was the first time you saw this one?
I'm sure you showed me this one. I'm like absolutely sure of it.
Yeah. What's the kind of like the connection I'm going at here is that I was shown this movie.
You brought it back from that trip.
I brought it back. Yeah. This movie was released in 2002, and Dog Soldiers. I remember Nikki, my manageress at Cafe Biba. She was so cool. She put me on to a bunch of English films, like cool English films that I hadn't heard of before. So Dog Soldiers was one of them. And then another one was called The Craze. And I thought she meant The Craze, like C-R-A-Z-E. But no, it was The Craze, K-R-A-Y-S. And it talks about like these... I think it's these brothers. Anyways, it's like really, really cool film. Anyways, I watched Dog Soldiers and brought this back. I loved it at the time. I loved watching it again. What did you think?
Yeah, so this is, well, I love this film. It was really fun to watch again, too. And this is another Neil Marshall film. We already reviewed The Descent. You and I both loved that movie. And there is some similarities between the two, but definitely this is like Neil Marshall's first big film he's doing himself. He not only wrote this, directed this, he edited this. Like, wow, this guy did. I bet you anything, he probably shot a few of the shots himself, and he's not even credited. It just feels like it's a one man show. It feels really like a particular vision, and you see it in this one. One of the things specifically that I'm going to talk about in this pod for sure is the way it's cut, because there is some really interesting editing in this. So yes, I was super excited. I knew you would love this because it's all taking place in the Scottish Highlands. But you told me this, and I had to go look it up on IMDb because I didn't believe you. So I don't know much about Scotland. I've only been there once for about a week, and I toured around, but I didn't realize you could have this kind of isolation that takes place in this movie in Scotland. I thought it'd be too populated to have these huge bouts of isolation. But then you also told me I didn't realize it was not even filmed there.
No, it was filmed in Luxembourg. And when you think about, the ideas and like the bouts of isolation, you know, you got to think like the two main population centers, and this is excluding when you have Inverness and you've got Aberdeen on the east coast, that it's a little bit more north. Inverness is quite north, but you've got Edinburgh and you've got Glasgow, but they're like quite south, okay? Closer to the English border. Mm-hmm. But even where I was, like even when you get up to a town called Balloch, which is, you know what I mean, an hour and a half outside, and then you get up to Pitlochry, where I was, in Kilkenny, call it the gateway to the Highlands. Like, the two of the most striking things that I noticed was how, and you'll see this in the film as well, even though, it's filmed in Luxembourg, but again, they're trying to make it look like it's the Scottish Highlands, is just how hilly it is and how undulating the land is. Like, it's got a very rustic, robust type feel to it, right? You know, you watch Braveheart, you see them running on the top of mountains and stuff. And it becomes more like that the more north you get. Rob, before we get into the one-line challenge, is there anything you want to kind of add on to the top here?
Yeah, the only thing I was thinking is, I don't think we've done a werewolf film yet, right? This is our first one. I was thinking, like, is there a deep connection to werewolves in Scotland? I did a quick Google search, so this is by no means an academic, you know, and academic research, but there was this like myth of the wolver, which at times can be actually a friendly creature as well as something that would attack if like provoked. But I don't think there's a deep connection between Scotland and werewolves, is there?
There's something ancient and relic about werewolves. You know, this film, for our review for it, was drawn out of a poll that we put out on Twitter, and there was, I think The Loved Ones was a film that we put on there, Dog Soldiers, The Howling, and then there's one other one. I don't know that there's many really great werewolf films.
Oh, that's a very good question, because I was thinking about that too.
You know, we can talk about it a little bit later on, but one of the things Neil Marshall kind of mentioned in terms of doing a werewolf film is that it's ambitious, just for the simple fact that you got to make these things look fucking decent.
Yeah.
And he just said, he was just very emphatic about it and said, you know, when you kind of jump into the realm of CGI and you try to make these things like IE, again, like a Van Helsing kind of thing, he just didn't think it looked good. So he had to spend the time to use practical effects. Thank you.
Yeah.
And what are practical effects? It's more expensive. So essentially, to do like a vampire film or to do like a ghost film, it was a lot cheaper. So this was an ambitious film for this cat.
Well, yeah, it's not a big budget. This is what, $2 million budget or something?
How did he make those werewolves look so good at such a cheap budget?
I'll tell you, like, this is what I was going to talk about, the editing. A lot of it has to do with how you don't get to see them for too long.
It's actually a great point. What's the longest you actually see? And I'm talking about with frontal light, because there's times when you actually have a prolonged look at them, but they're backlit, so you can't see anything in the face, right? There's a couple of times at the end where you get like a decent shot of the face, but it's never for more than 2 seconds or 3 seconds, right? Mm-hmm. So Rob, as a filmmaker, do you think they're doing that just so you don't have time to kind of pick out some of the non-attention to details that might be in the mask making or the makeup?
I think it's the movement. Like the werewolf face, like the bodies can move, but the longer you look at them, the more human in a costume, you start to think they look. And then the face can't move that much, I don't think. So the quick cuts really help hide all of that. And he does another great job where he always throws them into the corners of rooms and shadows. They're always kind of emerging out of a shadow.
Yeah.
And like you said, he does all those tricks where he backlights them so you always get a sense of them, but you don't get to really look at them. And we'll talk about the editing later too, because he makes sure that he didn't just do it for the scenes where the wolves are in it. He uses that frenetic cutting style in at least two particular scenes that I can identify where he really creates drama and creates like anxiety with this super frenetic cutting.
Yeah.
And that's – so I love that he thought to like, I'm going to keep using this style even if the wolves aren't in it, because I want to like – I want that style to be part of the film, not just an excuse whenever the werewolves show up.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Rob, listen, before we get into this, well, we're already into it, man. Let's get into it deeper and let's get down with the one-line challenge. Who is going first tonight?
I think I have to go first, right? You did.
Well, let's go. Listen, Rob, this is, you know, I would say that during podcasting and all our time spent together the last year, I have learned a lot from you, Rob, but I can honestly say this is not one of your strengths.
I beat you last week clean on Scream. I kicked your ass on Scream, 2022 Scream.
I'm not a huge fan of that film, man. I feel like I just didn't believe in it, so I couldn't bring it. But tonight is going to be a different situation, Rob. Okay, so let's go, baby.
All right, here we go. And I'm not pre-writing this. I'm not IMDBing this. This is raw Lendrum off the top of his head. Ready?
Yep.
Here we go. Dog soldiers. A platoon of Scottish soldiers enters a training mission in an isolated area of the Scottish Highlands, only to discover that this land is occupied by ancient werewolves, and they are forced to fight for survival as they try to hold down a stationary location and battle their way out of that forest. Dog soldiers.
See, the thing is with this challenge is that
you can't do 2 sentences. I had to throw an and in just to keep it going.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. That was actually pretty good. I feel like you were confident. See, the thing is, this is as much of a mental challenge as it is like a kind of like a wordsmith challenge. The minute you know that you're going off the top, it's like not going to be work. All right, here we go. Dog soldiers. Army men on a mission. Werewolves at night. A rogue commander leads his troops into harm's way, only to face destruction at the hands of the one for whom he searches for. Dog soldiers.
Now, you do like beat poetry. You do like... You're like, ba-dum-ba-dum, soldiers, werewolves.
Was there
an... Your punctuation in that doesn't make any sense to me. That is not one line. That was at least 3 sentences.
Rob, let's get into this. Let's take a look at the film. And one of the things with this film is that they actually use a lot of language that might not be familiar to the layman in Canada and the United States.
Yes. So you being our Scottish expert here, having spent, I don't know, what'd you spend, a year and a half there, and being of Scottish roots, what's up to Miss Roberts, Mrs. Roberts? I got a list of words here, and you're going to have to help me. You know, I kind of know what some of them mean because I've heard them, but like at the same time, I want to know what the actual meaning is. So I'm going to start you with softball. This phrase comes up several times in the movie. They say stuck in. What is stuck in?
Okay, when you get stuck in on something, that's one of the first things. And I'll use a lot of – I'm going to reference a lot of the guys off my soccer team, right? Ray Curley, Mark Fitzpatrick, Little John. These guys These guys use a lot of these words, right? So when you get stuck in on something, it means you're kind of like you would make a tackle on an opposing player, like a very aggressive tackle.
This one I know, but It's, I just find this word funny because, like, I read in British books and they say, oh, I have to put petrol in the car. I'm like, why do they not call it gas like we do? Why do they call it petrol? Is gas because they talk like gas to them is like air?
Like natural gas. And then petrol is like petroleum.
Yeah, like I get because it's so much more actually particular to what they're talking about. But like when if we were to go over there and say like I got to pump the car full of gas, what would they think I'm saying?
You'd have to pump the car full of like natural gas. Like you would be running your car on propane, like a forklift.
Okay.
It's, okay. So petrol is gas.
Right. Okay. Okay. At one point, like I think they're trying to find a phone or something. And I think the girl, it's the woman who says it's like 50 miles as the crow.
As the crow. Okay,
as the crow flies. Is that the expression?
As the crow flies, right? So this is an expression, 50 miles as the crow flies. And this is one of the things. I remember I was out playing one game and I've actually heard them say, oh, it's 20 miles as the crow flies. So that's like, it's 20 miles in distance, but as the crow flies. So I guess straight.
It's
so
like it's diagonal. 20
miles straight. Yeah. Yeah. It's like kind of point A to point B, right? So where's the nearest phone? Well, 50 miles as the crow flies, but you may not be able to fly like the crow. You may have to take roads and you may, you know what I mean? Actually, there's a really funny thing. Kevin McKidd at one point, he asks her two questions in succession. He goes, this is when they, you know, anybody that's seen the film, they end up in the abandoned sort of, not the abandoned, like the country house. And he is now, because his sergeant is, and Rob, I'm going to bring him back in a second. I just want to say something. His sergeant is injured. So he's kind of taking command, right? He's like the lieutenant. Mm-hmm. He's a good soldier. He goes, where's the nearest phone? She goes, 50 miles as the crow flies. And then he goes, where's the nearest population center? And she goes, she gives him this look like, couldn't you, like she goes, you mean town?
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of funny because she kind of gives him this look like, why did you call it a population center? You just could have called it.
He's using military language.
He's using military, exactly. He's using military town. But anyways, 50 miles to crow flies, 50 miles straight.
Okay, so the other one that occurred to me was, now in the movie they keep saying, oh, take the piss or all. Oh,
yeah.
But at one point the guy says, that's a piece of piss.
And
I was like, what? A piece of piss?
If Rob, if you ask me to, you know, Rob, can you help me do something, right? And I'm like, ah, oh, it's a piece of cake, no problem. They don't say that over in the UK. They say, oh, it's a piece of piss. like because it's easy to pee. It's a piece of piss. So that's, and actually I heard Ray Curley say that one time. Oh, it's a fucking piece of piss, mate. It's like, it just means the piece of cake.
See, I would have interpreted that as like he's saying this thing's a piece of garbage. Like this is fucking piss, this thing.
So that's what I thought. No, it's a piece of piss. Like it's just easy. Anyways, hopefully people enjoy that little primer of language to do an English to English translation. All right, Rob, I want to talk about some of the characters. One of the things that I love about this film and why I watched it four times in the last week, I was sick and I was home, is just it's nice and it's refreshing when you have a horror film, a scary film, an action film, any kind of film, but the performances are quality.
Mm-hmm.
The storytelling is quality. The time spent developing characters and developing relationships and building, I call it building infrastructure, right? Like anything that is worth its salt needs to be built from the ground up, grassroots. This movie, they do that. You get to know these characters. You understand what makes them tick. You see how they connect with each other. Rob, talk to me about Sir Davos Seaworth, the Onion Knight, a.k.a. Liam Cunningham.
Our first scene introduces us to Cooper, but as well, it also introduces us to Ryan, who is his superior, as Cooper's trying out for like the SEAL team, right? Like it's like, is it SEALs? Who are they? They're like the elite soldiers.
They're like this. Yeah. He's basically, I guess, auditioning for like special forces.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so Cooper is like a really good candidate. He's evaded capture for like over almost a full day, 22 hours.
Yeah.
But, Ryan points out, you didn't kill my dog, and that's how I found you. You should have shot my dog as soon as you had a chance. And then just to fucking prove it to him, he asks him, okay, shoot my dog then. You've been caught, but show me you can do it. Cooper refuses to do it because the exercise is over, not because he's against killing dogs, but you can tell he doesn't want to do it. And so he doesn't get the gig. And Ryan's like, you know, he is a cold as ice military man who, I think even the line, I think you actually wrote down here, the line he says is, I'm looking for a man of action, not of deeds. And basically what he's saying is, I don't need your moral high ground. I need you to do the things I need you to do when I tell you to do them and be able to pull them off. So Cooper doesn't get into the special forces because Ryan's too much of an asshole. And Ryan even shoots the damn dog just to prove like how cold his heart he is. I love this actor. It's interesting to see him so young, eh? Because Liam Cunningham, I'm so used to him as Davis Seaworth, of course.
You don't believe him. I understand that. It sounds like nonsense. But if destiny has brought Daenerys Targaryen back to our shores, it has also made Jon Snow king in the North.
And as a hero, as like a man who has integrity and is like, you know, become a really interesting character in Game of Thrones. He's a great voice actor too, by the way. He's in He-Man, the new He-Man.
By the power of Grayskull,
and also, he's the man at arms. And then the other thing, and for us, you know, Jamie, you and I are listening to a lot of podcasts. He is the voice in a new one called Impact Winter, where it's like a vampire story. So I've been listening to that. It's an audio drama. Recommended, actually, for those who like that stuff. Anyway, he's a really good actor. And like, it's interesting seeing him, A, as a villain, and B, so much younger, because he really gives me Dracula vibes in this movie.
You're right. To see him younger as, like, okay, he's not just like an asshole. This guy's like fucking like a dickhead. He doesn't smile once. Like, he's so unapologetically committed to duty. But he also, I feel like it goes even beyond that. He doesn't even crack and break eventually when, you know, he gets mortally injured. And then he's nursed back to health by, you know, this, and we can talk about the plot and sort of how everything functions, but Pertwee and McKidd and the team, they basically take him from death's doorstep and nurse him back to health or help him. And he's still like, is defiant.
Oh, they were my men!
Get up, you shit. You know what we can do. Give us a fighting chance!
In terms of how he kind of wants to connect with these people, because he's there for like...
Did you find that confusing, though?
Well, I do. You find out a little bit later that he was. They were on a special mission to actually capture one of the werewolves. The only thing I didn't understand is that he clearly understood the danger of trying to deal with these things. And when he was injured and he was with this team, why wouldn't he divulge the information sooner in order to perhaps give them an advantage in trying to capture the werewolves? The only thing I could think of,
just stay alive. Like, why doesn't he join them, pick up a gun and help them hold the fort down and try to fight with them?
Well, two things. Either he is a man of duty right till the end, or he understands that the transformation process has already begun because he's done research with his team and he understands sort of what happens when, because, you know, if you're injured by one of the werewolves, you're going to turn. Or if you're somehow infected, any kind of cut, any kind of blood starts the process up, right? There's a little bit of convoluted, a little bit ambiguity with that, with some of the other characters later on in the film. But he's like, he doesn't smile. But getting back to Sir Davos Seaworth in Game of Thrones, he was amazing in that as like the quiet hero. Never was too over the top, never was too... I thought he was amazing. I thought he was an amazing villain, Rob. Mm-hmm. I thought he just... You know, there's one line where the werewolves, who seemingly know how to like fucking, they're like the gremlins, right? They can like wire up a panel.
They cut the power.
Hey, eh? they're able to
they,
cut
they
the
cut
power.
The generator. They fuck
they
up
cut the
car.
Generator. And McKidd goes, oh, they've cut the power.
They've shut down the generator. They can't see because they can see in the dark, and you're afraid of it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Because they can see in the dark, and then the edit and cut, and you're afraid of it. It was like a chilling line, right? Mm-hmm. And when I went back and looked at it, the edit and the cut is really quick. I would have maybe added like a half a second onto the cut just to let it kind of simmer a little bit more. But he's very intense. And because of how he is, the intensity, it sets a complete tone for the film.
Mm-hmm. And I also, think go ahead.
Well, let me just finish it off by saying that I think that he kind of functions as like the ceiling, as the floor, and that he kind of really underpins the story with his intensity. If he were to be good, I think it becomes a little bit more flimsy. And because he is able to kind of hold this position of, again, intensity throughout the entire film, you're just on edge.
And the antagonist. He functions as an antagonist.
For sure.
Which is what's great. You're right. We don't need him to be good because the story already has these group of soldiers, like four or five of them, that are all buddies or at least are all fighting for each other. So we don't need him to also join those ranks. You know, you could bring him in and make him still an antagonist where he's making decisions that, you know, they don't agree with. And he's like using up their ammo or doing things that they didn't want to do. But yeah, it's almost better the way they cut it. They work him because now he's just like this dark voice in the back of their heads just saying,
yeah,
it's never going to work. You're going to get killed, whatever. Also, he really fucking hates dogs. Tries to kill the second dog, that beautiful border collie. I fucking love border collies, by the way. I grew up with three of them. Tries to kill this border collie, and luckily, one guy pukes on the back of his head right before he can pull the trigger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like the stew, eh? It's like the Goldilocks. They come into the cabin, they eat the porridge, and then he pukes it on his head.
I love that, by the way. That kid, I don't know if it's a direct reference to Goldilocks, but there is a real, like, nice fairy tale kind of setup to that. Like, they're in their house, they're in the wolf's house. It takes them a while to figure that out too. And it's not immediately apparent to them that this house actually is the family that is now outside the house turned to werewolves trying to get back in.
That takes some time to kind of like, there's little nuggets around that you start to figure it out. And then you understand that. And that's one of the things of the film is like, you start to ask yourself, okay, was this a setup from the beginning?
Yeah.
Or did it turn into a setup? Or did it turn into something a little bit more diabolical throughout the, you know, through as they transgress through the story, right?
But well, yeah, Ryan lays that out. He actually says your squad, the second squad, who are the dog soldiers, or I don't know what you call these guys, but they're like grunts, right? They're not special forces.
Yeah.
They've been brought in on a training mission. They don't even have live rounds, although they have them. They have rounds available to them, but they're not. They didn't start with live rounds, and they enter the forest as an exercise. And then at first they think, oh, we're against the special forces here, so like let's like do a really good job. Then they realize, no, these are just bodies of the special forces that have been killed by something. And then Ryan confirms later, like, yeah, you guys were here to be the bait for the wolves, and then we were going to catch them.
Let me ask, like, just really quickly, when you got the vampire vibes from him, is it just because, like, his haircut?
Just because
he's got, like, that
widow's peak,
like that Robert DeLeo Stone Temple Pilots. kind of
very
thing
George
happening.
Clooney almost. He's got that little widow's peak. He's also, the way they shoot him, he's usually in very stark darkness. Like, his hair becomes very black turtleneck. Black turtleneck. Yeah. It just has a Nosferatu kind of look.
Totally.
To
it. He is a great actor and he is a great villain. What about Kevin McKidd, AKA Tommy from Trainspotting?
It was Wednesday morning. We were in the volley playing pool. That much is true. But Begbie is playing absolutely fucking gash. He's got a hangover so bad he can hardly hold the fucking cue, never mind pot a ball. I'm doing my best to lose, you know, trying to humour him, like, but it's not doing any good. Every time I touch a ball, I seem to pot something. Every time Begbie goes near the table...
AKA the dude from Grey's Anatomy that's still on that show, right?
Yeah.
Like, but you know, when you actually think about it, Rob, when you actually think about it, he's gone from like a... So he played like a sergeant in a military movie. He's a doctor in an American film. Like, by all accounts, this guy's broken into the American market. Played a soccer player turned heroin addict in Guy Ritchie that did Trainspotting?
No. Guy Ritchie does like a Snatch and
No, fuck. Who did Trainspotting? Who's your man that did Trainspotting?
That's the guy who did 22 Weeks Later, 22 Days, 28 Days Later. isn't it?
Fuck, what's his name? Anyways, groundbreaking film. Like, I think Kevin McKidd's pretty dope, actually, as an actor. But
so for me, I actually loved him in Rome. I watched Rome.
And that's right. Yeah, he was in Rome, too.
Yeah, he's Lucius Verones or Varinus. I haven't watched that in a while, but I remember binging that series on DVD. I think he's a brilliant actor. Like he's got kind of a pretty boy look, but then once he starts yelling and getting angry, you can tell he's not that pretty. And like, he kind of like, he's got very veiny, muscular look, and he looks like a tough guy when you get close to him.
He's like, yeah, he's like the ginger dude.
And he's absolutely great in this movie too. Like, his character is just like, he's a good guy, but he's very like methodical. He understands what he's doing. He's definitely could have been a special force, but we find out in the beginning, because he didn't shoot the dog, he doesn't get in. But he knows how to take over the team really quickly once Sergeant Wells goes down. And you like him right away, even though there's nothing really like friendly about him. It's just that he's good with his people. He's doing it the right way.
Exactly. Like, he's solid. But I actually asked that question as well. It's like, why do you like him? Okay, you like him because he's principled.
Yes.
But I think you like him. You like him more than what he actually is, because he's set against Ryan immediately in the film. Mm-hmm. He's a principled character. He seems to have a good plan. But there's a time in the film there where he perhaps doesn't listen to reason, and perhaps maybe should, when things are starting to get really fucking hairy in the movie. Do you remember that? Do you know which scene I'm talking about, when he has that nice little exchange with Pertwee?
When he punches him out?
Well, that's the best scene in the whole fucking film, right? When
we'll get to that. But which one are you talking about?
So you know, this is after they've totally bollocks the let's blow up the barn and kill them where all are sleeping, which was the stupidest plan ever.
That was near the end.
Yeah, this is near the end, right? Where they have the conversation about, he says, you know, do you see what's happening to me? This is not normal, right? Like, he's basically starting to question everything that's happening. He's seeing his body. He understands. This is Wells. This is Sean Pertwee, right? And he's saying, I'm turning into a vampire, or a werewolf. Mm-hmm. People around us are dying. I'll hold down the fort. You need to get the fuck out of here. Mm-hmm. And my kid's like, I don't know what's staying. We're going to see it out, boy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, no, there's time, man, for us to do it. You know what I mean? There's time, mate. You know? Like, he's just, that's where.
Because this is why you like him, right?
Well, do you? I don't know. Like, it kind of like feeds into the fact that I wish he was a little bit more of a free thinker, right?
But horror movie, there's that like, no, I can't let you stay here. No, every war movie too has got that moment of, I can't let you stay behind. You got to come with this. And then they got to talk him out of it. And like, no, I got to sacrifice myself. There's no other way. And then finally they convince him and they leave. This is like tried and true war movie technique, right?
Yeah. He's got his exchange at the beginning of the film with the different characters. So you definitely see that he's a respected lad, and that he's not going to buck to pressure. He's going to be his own man. And then he just kind of stays there the whole way, right? Like, he doesn't really vacillate off that a little bit.
No.
What about maybe the actual actor that steals the whole show? What do you think about Wells? This is Sean Pertwee. This is our man from Event Horizon. Mm-hmm. The guy that's like, you know, another pilot. And he's a pilot, but he's also a military man. A similar, you know, character profile in this film.
Well, and they let him have that soliloquy near the top of the film, right, where he tells a story about his friend the Middle Eastern War,
yep,
where he gets blown up by an LED. No, LED by an LED. What's it called?
Gets blown up by a fucking 60-watt LED.
No, sorry. That's disrespectful.
IED.
IED. He gets blown up by IED. And the story is fantastic, because I love the idea of, like, you know, they find the one body part that had the tattoo of the devil on the guy's body.
Yeah.
And that one piece of his body was preserved, but everything else was blown to bits. Very cool story. But, yeah, the way he tells it, and he's not telling it to make a joke. He's not telling it to, make fun of the guy who blew up. He's actually saying, like, you know, shit happens out here, guys. Like, this is real. And you know, you got to like live the best life you can out of this. And he even says at another point in the movie, like, I've learned to be open-minded. Like, I know I could be killed at any time. So he's like a professional. He even says, I'm a professional soldier. So, yeah, he really ropes you in with that story. Like, he really magnetizes this character. He's really good with his guys, but he's definitely in charge and they respect him. The story does that classic thing where he has to go down for our character to step up, right?
I don't know why more movies don't do this more often. And I feel like so many movies today are in a rush to move through it and have just meaningless scenes that don't really help propel the story in any meaningful way. Like, for example, this the time that they spent, you know, the boys just kind of chatting, the boys talking, the time spent of Wells talking about that story, right? It basically makes it plausible that when they get into the farmhouse that they're able to fend off these werewolves for as long as they can, and you actually believe it because of their close-knit unit, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. It's also like, so this guy, he's out there the werewolves attack him and he gets his fucking guts spliced open, right? And they got the sausages all out there. They manage. It's like hilarious, right?
It's like bratwurst. I didn't find this funny. You keep saying these are funny scenes. I'm like, I didn't get roped into the comedic side of this.
God, it's like a, you know, Jimmy Dean sausage, man. It's like literally, anyways. So they get him back into the, you know, eventually they've got Megan, who's the zoologist, and she picks them up in the Range Rover and they get them back to the farmhouse and they get him up to the top floor. And he's like freaking out and they're trying to put, like, Kevin McKidd goes on this like soliloquy about how crazy glue was invented or used for the Vietnam War, about basically trying to stitch up or to fix soldiers that had been wounded in action.
What's the glue for?
Ever wonder why the best thing that super glue sticks together is your fingers? Give it. Forget your grandma's china cups. This stuff was developed for the Vietnam War to patch up broken soldiers.
And it was a quick way to kind of bond skin. And so they've got like, you got to go see this, like anybody that's just watching the film. They're like putting so much super glue on this guy. He's freaking out. They're pumping him full of Scotch whiskey. He sits up. He's asking to get his ass. Like, he says, just fucking punch me. Just fucking hit me, you pussy. And he hits him one time and then he knocks him out.
I'll stick. You bomb.
I'll tell you something. Someone better get fucking stuck in soon because it's really starting to hurt. Cooper. Knock me out. Hit me. Oh, you fucking pussy. Hit me.
It's such a funny scene. It's such a good scene. Like, he just shows how. And he actually plays a drunk guy really well and a guy that's in serious distress. Mm-hmm. And then he gets hit and then he's right out. Like, I didn't know much about him, but he's one of those actors that the more you see of him and the more movies, the more you appreciate him and just how good of an actor he is. Mm-hmm. He's fantastic, man.
All right, so Jimmy, the last character that we should probably talk about is Megan. And this is going to, I guess, segue us into plot a bit, because Megan is this linchpin character. She's the zoologist. She's gone, like, the backstory is she's gone out there to research this myth of these werewolves. She at one point would have discovered them. When she discovers them, she, like, I'm going to spoil everything here just so that we can.
No, there's spoilers.
Let's try to like, yeah, it's a podcast. Let's try to like spell out how this all worked. She discovered the family, got bit, became one of the members of the family because she's becomes one of the werewolves. Then Ryan's crew comes in and she sees this as an out potentially for herself. But then Ryan's crew gets decimated. He's the only one left. He's been infected. The second wave of soldiers comes in, the grunts, and she thinks potentially maybe they can help get out. But now that she's heard the story from Ryan's lips that this was all just a way to try to catch them,
yeah,
that she has recognizes now, I'm never getting out of here. So she tricks them into blowing up the van, the garage or whatever, the barn where there was another car in there. And so they can't escape. There's nothing left to escape on. There's no car left. There's nothing to leave with except to go on foot. And then she reveals, guess what? I'm also a vampire, and I just let them in the back door.
Yeah.
And then battle ensues, and she gets iced. But did you find that a bit convoluted? I mean, as a character, I thought she was great. Like, her performance was good. But then, like, to me, there's some of the weird parts, like when she decides to set up on the piano and play them all a tune while they're sitting there waiting for the werewolves to attack.
Wait, no, they're waiting for fucking tea. Kevin McKidd is us. Let's put some tea on.
You were joking about this, but to me it makes sense. They're trying to stay up all night long because it's nighttime that the wolves are out, so they're getting caffeine into themselves.
Yeah, I guess. And there's more caffeine in tea than anything. It just, I don't know, seems like a strange thing. I think adrenaline would be taken over. So she's heard that there's gunfire out in the woods, and she just so happens to have her Range Rover right when they're running from the werewolves. Remember, they're being attacked by the werewolves.
At that point,
and,
yeah.
At that point, right? Like the infantry crew with Wells and McKidd and all the boys, who actually, they lost a team member out there. You know, one of the things is it's implied that she's working with Ryan in order to catch them. So I can kind of see how that makes sense. She knows that there's people out there. She hears the gunfire. She comes to rescue them. She's not really forthright in terms of where she's bringing them. She's like, I know we can stop here on our way on to somewhere else, right? So she's being a little bit dastardly with that. She's definitely, you know, and then for sure she kind of misleads them. Although I do think she's like on their side until she gets confirmation from McKidd, who makes a passing comment saying, oh, we're going to fucking try and kill them all. You know what I mean? And then she says, well, they're actually a really nice family. He kind of fluffs it off. And then if you actually look at the movie and watch the camera, there's a couple, like her facial expressions are meant to say a lot in this film.
I thought that too. Yeah. Like that they had double meanings.
For sure.
And definitely. She's watching people like kind of like with a, like, what are they going to do here? What are they going to do here?
Yeah. Ryan kind of like, they do that with Ryan a lot in the film as well. You know what I mean? He comes out and eventually tells like why he's really there as just before he's about to turn. I don't find it overly problematic. I just think that there was definitely a bunch of lines that needed to be connected from kind of far off distances to make her character make sense.
I wondered if something was changed on the editing floor, like that they said, well, we had her doing this, you know, do we need this line anymore? Or is there enough here to make this all hold together? And it just seems like something happened either from writing to shooting to editing that was a little off.
So I thought it was interesting that it's written in that she's actually a vampire. Or sorry, she's actually, I keep saying that. She's actually, that just goes to show you because of Blood of Night. She's actually a werewolf.
It's that time of the month.
That is connected to the family, but has not changed until she cut. The process doesn't start until she cuts her hand on the glass. That's unclear.
What does that
mean? Well, she's a werewolf and she's connected into the family, but she's able to control or suppress her transformation easier than the other ones. Is that because the other ones have been a werewolf for 5 years and she's only been it for 5 months? Or is that because she's younger? Is that because she didn't get fully infected at the beginning? It just raises a lot of questions.
Yeah, but
one of the things that's very clear in this film is that she's become protective of the family because she makes them blow up the barn, which, you know, blows up the barn. She makes them go to... Not makes them go to, but they've got the plan. She doesn't say anything. They get it where they go to get the Range Rover, which ends up killing somebody, another military member. And what does she really do to help them escape or to help them in the situation?
She takes photos. And like when the werewolves are literally attacking, she helps like fight them off, which is the weird part.
Yeah,
right?
So she's actually...
It's like you're saying. She's actually like plan-wise, like grand scheme plan. She's fucking up all their... escape routes, but then like hands on the like boots on the ground when they're actually battling the werewolves, she's helping them keep them away.
But she's doing
so potentially she's trying to like save their lives, but she's also trying to make sure that these soldiers don't kill the werewolves. I guess maybe that's the...
Well, maybe that's exactly what it was. Maybe she saw it as a way out, but didn't want to inflict harm on the werewolves mm-hmm. because she mm-hmm. knows them not just as werewolves. She knows them as people.
Yeah, and she's a zoologist who finds just this whole idea fascinating. They do say that the family's been there for centuries. So whether or not the exact, you know, like as in the family's lineage has been there for centuries.
One of the best scenes actually is, you know, when they talk about the werewolves and the families, right? When they get into, Megan brings them back to this like this staging house. I guess they're gonna fix up Wells and then they're gonna move on. That's kind of the plan until they go out back to the Range Rover and see that like the engine's been fucking destroyed. A kid goes out with his, you know, one of his privates. And they've got the flares, right? Or they've got like the light. And mm-hmm. then you see like the shot of the werewolves really for the first time where you actually see them standing and they're backlit in the shadows. And he goes, don't look. Don't look at them. And the other guy goes, how can I not fucking look at them? Like it's really good. But one of the things is, so they subverted like a classic horror trope where you may, like that's a jump scare, man. You're not expecting that. And you could have had like a string or you could have had something a percussive element to kind of enunciate that. Mm-hmm. There's no music.
In the whole movie, there's action music.
But no, like in that one scene, and you're right, in other scenes, there's no music, man.
I was thinking about that too, audio wise. Do you remember the scene where when they get in her car and start driving? They're driving through the Highlands and you could see that they're inside the car and it's bumping around and you could hear their dialogue clear as day, but they're tearing through the forest on dirt roads and there is no sound. And I know it's here for effect. Like they've chosen to not add the foley here, like the
sound
of the car and the bumping and the, you know, cause it would be overwhelming, but there is a weird chilling effect where it's like they're also trying to slow the movie down a little bit and give you a moment to breathe. But you're not hearing any of that natural, like, what noise that should be there. Instead, you're just hearing them speak inside the car.
Exactly. It brings it really close. It makes it, you know,
It feels weird because in retrospect, now looking at it, 30 years later or 20 years later, it feels almost cheap. Like it was a mistake, but I'm sure it's not. It's a choice.
Let's shift gears here and... One of the things that really jumps out at you is a lot of the filmmaking elements in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, what jumps out at you with the way Dog Soldiers was made?
So, like we said, it feels like it's on a low budget, but they really did a good job of covering that. I think definitely now you can see a bit of the cheapness in the way it's shot. For example, they do a lot of film shooting in the woods. And in that very first scene, that was so great with the campers getting killed. I don't think any of that sound is natural. It all looks like to me like it's been dubbed back in later. So there's these moments where it feels a little cheap sometimes. But they do some really clever tricks to add excitement, but also to increase the anxiety with this frenetic editing. And firstly, just going back to the camera for a second, the werewolves often have like a second have their own POV, and you see them running through the woods, and it's like night vision almost, and so you get the sense that they can see things differently, like they're not seeing the darkness the way the humans are. But the other thing is the frenetic way it's cut, and we mentioned this with the werewolves that like they cut it so quick that you do get a good look at them sometimes, enough to know that they're werewolves, to get a good, like when they do something cool, but they don't spend too much time so that you get to like kind of see the seams, which I think is very smart. But there's two specific scenes where they did that in the movie to create the same energy and it didn't involve the werewolves. The first example is, I forget the guy's name, is it Bruce? Bruce is in the woods and he's the first guy to encounter a werewolf and we don't see the werewolf. It's just Bruce is like, he knows something's out there. And his gun is not working. He keeps trying to reload it, right?
Yep.
Do you remember the scene when he's in the woods? Watch that scene carefully because the camera cuts from multiple angles very quickly. So at times you can imagine that it's from the werewolf's point of view, back to his, back to just like a movie, like the film, the Eye of God kind of camera has just found him again. And it cuts like really quick as he's trying to like pull this magazine out, put it back in. And he's like, his anxiety is through the roof because he thinks somebody's after him and he can't get the gun to work. So finally he starts running And this is when he runs himself right into a tree and, you know, impales himself. But it was a really clever way to like build that anxiety and also to establish this technique before we see werewolves. Then the second time is when they're in the house, they're trying to find all the silver in the house. And there's this really cool montage where they're just grabbing items like plates and spoons and forks and whatever they can find. They're trying to find whatever silver they can find. And it's just cut really quick and like, you know, it's just frenetic. And again, you know, it results that they find that there is no silver in the house. But it was a really cool way to do that. And again, like I said, they do this with the werewolves attack. And so these are cool ways that they put that style in without just saying without just doing it when the werewolves attack. And the werewolves, you were saying great moments when they're backlit. A couple great moments we get to look at their face when they're like they're biting someone's head off or something in the garage.
You know, you give us the perspective from the filmmaker. What would be the advantage in a low budget film using all those frenetic cuts?
Because it allows you to create speed and dynamic and make it feel like it's like when we cut sports promos, we cut them pretty fast. Because watching a highlight, like say hockey is a great example. To watch a highlight, you have to watch like 20 seconds, right? The guy he skates, then he makes a move, then he takes a shot, he scores, then he does a reaction, right? And then there's like the team reaction. That takes like 20 seconds to show. But in a commercial, when you've only got 30 seconds to work with, you cut it from skate, shot, scores, react, and you do that in under three. Like it's super and you're driving the intensity by doing that. So that's one thing you're doing. You're creating energy. You're creating intensity. But you're also covering bad shots. And if you look at this early on in the movie, especially when they're walking through the highlands, there's some kind of meh, like kind of blah shots of the landscape. They would sometimes do it just to like do a transition shot when they want to go from one area to another. Or like we're going to go from the boys are walking. Now they're going to be sitting. They'll take one like wide shot. And it's not like great shoot. Like, it's not a great shot. So I think what happened there was like they only had a couple of days in the woods and they had what they had and it was handheld camera. So it was like we got to shoot whatever we can get and then, you know, then we got to move on. Like we can't spend our budget out here.
Okay. So I think, that's good. I think one of the things I noticed in the contrast of the film and maybe even a critique, but you go from the frenetic cutting to very like long kind of laborious shots, right? Where they're sitting down, they're talking, more monologues. I wonder if that's done on purpose as a specific contrast to, you know, when they're kind of regrouping in the country house, when they're sitting in the woods, like, you know what I mean? Like you definitely can feel that.
Like when Wells does the monologue, like they spend a lot of time on his face.
The second thing that I noticed too, and I wonder if it's just a pre-digital era, but is this movie feel or look extra grainy? Like it does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I noticed that too, because it's shot on real film.
Okay, so it's going to be
I don't know what
Panavision reel and all. Exactly. We don't know what the stock is, but I'm watching it you go back and you can look at a movie from 2002 and a lot of the movie looks or other movies look fucking way more crisp than this shit. Like this stuff looks like it just looks like you're there, right? Like you kind of
looks like a film from the
70s. It looks like a film from the 70s, right? And it just adds to the kind of the visceral feeling of the movie. Overall, Rob, how do you put the success rate on this film? Like, do you think what they produced for us to watch is good in terms of a werewolf film, how it looks, how it's portrayed on screen?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think the werewolves look really good. And like I said, they show them just enough. And I got to tell you one other thing that really, to me, drives the success of this film. We talked about how there's only two sets or three sets in the whole movie, right? There's like the woods, the car scene, which probably was shot on a studio lot, and then the house. How cool is it that they demolish this house. And they fight. The final fight scene, the escape scene, is them literally hammering through the walls.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And escaping the werewolves by, like, locking one door and then breaking the wall so they can get into the next room, blocking that room, hammering another hole. Like, I thought that was really cool. And I thought that was really tricky, like, stunt to pull off, but it made perfect sense on their budget again too, to be like, this is our set, we're going to do it all right here, and this big climax, we're actually going to destroy this set.
Yeah.
And we're going to, like, slip through crevices. Like, I thought that was pretty cool.
It was cool. Like, my one sort of critique that I wrote down, but I'm going to take that critique back, was, for me, when you're in a action film or a horror film, right, the death knell can be when you become static and stationary, when you sort of get to a point where you can't move anymore and then you stay there. Often you lose a lot of the momentum for the film. Like, for example, why everybody or I'm not saying you like it, but one of the things that the movie, or one of the movies that this one was compared to, was Predator. Now, the thing about Predator is this constant motion. There's this constant, like, sort of chase and trying to evade death by the predator. In this movie, they're picked up and they're brought to really a place where they're going to make their final stand. Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. 45 minutes they're in, even actually a little bit earlier, they're into the country house, which can be the end for some of these horror films. And for me, I felt like the film really slowed down. But I think what's kind of cool about it, and this speaks to the way they shot the werewolves, a lot of the frenetic camera angles that you talked about, is they're really able to kind of speed up the film. It climaxes to the end. Like, Rob, they've got the lighter with the hairspray fucking trying to incinerate the werewolf. Guy's got a spoon. He's going through the old plaster, like these old Scottish houses. Like, he's going through the wall. Then he's going through the ceiling. Then he ends up, you know, the best is, they're in the kitchen and then he ignites the gas line and fucking McKid's in the basement and you see all the bodies hung up on hooks and stuff down there. It's just like,
yeah, but that was a nice reveal too.
It was a great reveal to show, like, just like, you know, what's going on. They're, you know, got prosciutto down there, but it kind of was going really intense and then it slowed down. And then it started like a ball rolling down a hill. And then it just, if you watch the film, like, it just kind of, they run the decoy. They try to blow up the barn. And then they have, Megan comes in, the transformation. Yeah. Megan and Ryan are gone. The werewolves are in the house. And there's the final, like, just fucking free for all.
That's what I love. Like, they're trying these things to get out of there that are failing. They're finding new ways to, like make the house more, like, fortify the house more. I love that there was all these dynamics. And I think it speaks to some of the films we like a lot that we've reviewed on, you know, Running Scared. We loved Anaconda. They're on the boat. You can't leave the boat. There's nowhere to go off the boat. So you gotta stay on the boat. Event Horizon, you're stuck in space and you're trying to figure out which ship you're going home on. And then you got to make that ship safe. So you're trying to go home on the one you came on, but now that doesn't work. Well, now you got to leave on this ship too. Like, I like that idea that you're like, it's all about survival. Tremors, you're stuck on the rock. Now, how do you get off the rock? Like, you're in this isolated area, and there's only there's only so much you can do to escape these things. So, I think we're drawn to these movies where the set is a character, and the set creates a difficulty. It creates a challenge for our characters to solve, as well as the monster that's knocking at the door.
You know, can you draw a connection to the way this movie is done to the way his next movie, The Descent, is done? Because I see a whole lot of similarities between even just sort of like the story arc and just the way that it's all pieced together.
It is interesting to think about that, because he likes to do a set that's like, you go into a location.
Yeah, I was just thinking the exact same thing.
Usually a remote, isolated location.
Yeah, over a day. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then... there's an unexpected monster, and then there's a level of betrayal between characters. He likes to use those elements in any given film. It seemed to be something he likes to revisit, and they work. I mean, I love that. I mean, you don't know if the characters you're with are trustworthy. You don't know if you can survive this place, never mind this monster. This monster is, you know, got advantages over you in this place.
It's classic.
Say it, Jamie. Say it.
It's classic horror. It's, you know, I say man or woman versus man woman. Is man or woman versus the world? Like it's an existential threat. It's an internal threat. It's an immediate threat. It's a macro, meso, micro. Like he's, I think Neil Marshall, at least from these two, at least two movies, he's writing on at least three different levels of storytelling. And that's even harder to write because, you know what I mean? You've got the werewolf threat, but then you're right. You've got the threat between the military itself. You've got this sort of the internal conflict that happens between Megan and herself and what she wants to do to help these guys or to be. It's just, there's the story is functioning on a lot of different levels. Same thing with The Descent, right? And I think a lot of similarities between the two films. So let's just finish up and review it.
All right. So, yeah, how do you pick a number on this one, James? I like it a lot, so it's going to be a high rating. Yeah. I'm just trying to think to myself, is there anything it could have done a little better? I think with a couple of things that we've identified have, and this is rating it from 2022, it does look a little cheap now when you look back on it. There are moments where you're like, looks like, but, you know, like, at the same time, I'm praising this film for creating such a great film out of a pretty small budget, well, a very small budget by Hollywood movie standards, like, and really like elevating, like doing a really cool, interesting, unique movie, doing one of the best werewolf movies I can think of. I mean, there's not many good ones, and maybe they're not a very interesting creature when you break it down, right? Like the vampire seduces you, right? What does the werewolf do? He chases you and eats you. Like it's pretty standard shit.
No, but I disagree. I think that I'll let you finish your review.
A good werewolf, a normal werewolf movie is about the person who is the werewolf fighting with that internal demon and trying to, you know, control themselves.
But that's not this film.
It's the interesting thing. They didn't even do that. And instead, that internal struggle is represented by these two groups of soldiers, one who's willing to do, you know, anything that the outfit, that the job tells them to do, that being Ryan's crew, get themselves killed, try to capture a werewolf for military purposes. And then there's the crew who's more like, no, like, we're going to stick together and we're going to help each other through this. And, you know, we're not, you know, we're people before we're soldiers. There is the internal struggle of Megan, who's like, I didn't want to be a werewolf. I am one now. I was hoping to get out of here, but now I also need to protect these people who have become my family, and I'm not going to let a bunch of soldiers kill them. But again, that kind of arrives because it's so black and white. She arrives at being a villain basically. And I kind of think that's a bit too simple. I wish we had felt her struggle a little more instead of it being a reveal. Cause if I look back on it, I don't see her struggling with these questions throughout the movie. I just see her like, sort of aiming them all in one direction or then the other direction. And then there's this big reveal at the end. But if this is really about her struggle, we should feel that more, right? But these are minor things because I just think it's a smart way to do a small movie. I love this like standoff thing, standoff in the house, trying to fortify it, trying to blast your way out. You got one guy injured upstairs. You got a bad guy downstairs cuffed to a chair. You got two guys who are scared out of their mind. You got one guy trying to hold it all together. And then you got that trustworthy border collie who gets you through everything. So I'm going to say there's some problems with the film that don't make it perfect. There are some aesthetic issues that I think I want to praise them for, but at the same time, there's that cheapness. So I'm going to come in at 4 footsteps. But I want to emphasize that I really think the editing in this is really clever at times. But there is some sort of gloss that has worn off this now that I watch it 20 years later. And there is some convoluted parts of the story that I'm still like, I guess that works, but it doesn't really hook me like I thought it would. But a 4, it's definitely a must watch.
All right, definitely a must watch. So I think that this film, one of the successes of it and why it's continued to, you know, generate loyal viewers is that I really feel like it resonated originally with an English audience because this is an English film. I think that the characters that are portrayed with those military characters. I think a lot of, you know, talking about soccer, kind of being hard, a little bit being stuck in. I think that a lot of English people can relate to that. I think so there was relatable characters with that. And I think the characters were portrayed by fantastic actors. And one of the things that I noticed when I was living over in Scotland, and one of the things that I see that's different between British film and like American media, is that I think the audiences expect more from the performances of the actors. And when you look at McKidd, Cunningham, and I would even say, you know, maybe Pertwee, maybe not so much McKidd, but Cunningham, they're just delivering fantastic performances. And this is a horror action film, but the performances are so good. I'm drawn to the screen. I want to watch more of them, right? Which I think is really important. So the viewership can identify and also expects good storytelling and good acting, which is being delivered, right? Plus, you knock in a clever take on a werewolf film that, and it's smart that they do it, because I would imagine it would be very expensive to start showing transformations of humans into werewolves on screen, and that clearly didn't have the budget to do it. So they wrote in a clever story about a family centuries old in the middle of nowhere that that time of the month, she said, right, which was kind of a funny line, that they change into werewolves and then they have to go hunt. The movie, for the exact same reasons, I'm not going to conjure new reasons for the same reasons that you mentioned, you know, some of it can look a little bit cheap. You kind of want and are left asking for more in some of the elements, you know, like the same three places they filmed and the look of the film and whatnot, I think could be improved upon. But all in all, for a werewolf film and for an action film, Rob, I was entertained in this film as an action film. I was watching guys trying to escape mm-hmm. for their lives, right? Or try to fight for their lives from an existential threat that just so happened to be a werewolf, which is super cool, and they're huge. And mixed in with great performances, really cool action, some really fucking hilarious lines, and just some funny performances and funny spots. It's entertaining. It's great. It is, for me, I'm going to give it the same rating that you gave it. I'm going to give it 4 footsteps out of 5. You know, one of the things that I would love to see is, and Neil Marshall talked about this, about how a sequel or like a reboot maybe could be some, you know, it could materialize in the future. And he actually mentioned less than 12 months ago that it would be more likely now than ever before in the last 20 years. So I think, like, don't you just think it's just a really cool concept for a werewolf film? Like, it's so simple, but it's so clever. They're not overthinking it. They're not trying to make it something. And again, that might just be out of more, you know, pragmatism than design. But for me, the movie just works on a lot of different levels. I can connect with it personally, which is another reason why I liked it. I like the actors. The performances are top-notch. 4 out of 5 footsteps. This has been great. I love this movie. Again, we don't actually say this, but we both fully recommend that you go watch this. There's a lot of people that I talk to that have not seen Dog Soldiers before that have never even heard of this movie. Mm-hmm. So definitely go check it out. Friggin' amazing.
I saw it on Apple, by the way. So if you want to look at it, just hit Apple in Canada as of, I think, like less than a few days ago.
Perfect.
So it is now available to rent or own on
perfect
Apple.
Time. Okay, yeah. Just before we get out of here, as always, come support us on Patreon. As always, send us an email at therunningscaredpodcast@gmail.com. As always, follow us at Twitter, at runningscaredpd. And as always, you can follow us on Instagram at runningscaredpod. One thing that is really, really cool is that Rob and I are going to be recording the third Jogcast this week. That means it's not too far away from being in people's hands. It's going to be good. It's for sure. We were talking about it before we got on tonight. We've spent a lot of time on this. We're going 3 months. It's going to be our best Jogcast to date. We know it's going to be the best one to run to. We think it's the best story. And it's going to be a lot of fun. We cannot wait to get this thing out to people, Rob.
Running Scared Podcast is written and produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts. This episode edited by Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts. Follow us on social media and tune in next time for another episode of Running Scared.
You have got to make that enough. This happened. Not just for me. My lads.